Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Richard Kellner, and I represent the appellant. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. I'm hoping to be very brief and get right to the point on what is the issue here. Now, a defendant is entitled to recover as a condition for dismissal under Rule 41A2, attorney fees for costs which were not useful for the continuing litigation between the parties. Now, in this particular case, the need for that type of determination was extremely important because there were two other actions that were pending at the time of the request for dismissal without prejudice. And they were class actions, one in New Jersey, one that was in California. And ultimately what happened was both of these cases were ultimately disposed of, and one, in fact, by a motion to dismiss. And the record really reveals here that the vast majority of the time that was awarded by Judge Fischer ultimately involved motions to dismiss, involved discovery, involved experts, which from our vantage point, if there was a full analysis, would have been something which would have been not assessed as a potential for fees.
Could I just, to clarify, are you arguing about the writ of mandate here? Because we're looking then at whether there was a clear error, whether the district court made a clear error of law, or are you arguing that about the conditional order of voluntary dismissal? Because I have some concerns about jurisdiction before we ever get to the Koch test.
Okay, I think the answer is both, and the fundamental problem that we have here, and this is right on the surface, is that Judge Fischer gave plaintiffs a Hobson's choice, essentially. He told plaintiffs that you can have your dismissal without prejudice, and I'll determine later what the amount will be. It'll be in this 100 to 110 range, but no determination was made.
But then what was actually awarded was the 100,000, the low end of the range. So I was having trouble seeing how this was distinguishable from UniOil, which seemed to be directly on point. And your client specifically said, no, I don't want to withdraw my motion, had the opportunity to do so. So how I was having trouble seeing how under UniOil we even have jurisdiction over that. That part of your claim.
Right. And the way that we have jurisdiction is multifold. First of all, the fact that there was a conditions imposed which were improper takes us out of that realm. So one of the conditions was that the attorneys would have to pay for this award, which under this court's decision in Hectathorn, is not proper. 41A does not allow for attorneys to be sanctioned. That's what this becomes, as a sanction.
I thought it was joint and several, because Hectathorn, doesn't it distinguish UniOil and say there it was joint and several, and at Hectathorn it was only on the attorneys, and therefore it's a sanction? So isn't UniOil still controlling on that issue?
No, Your Honor, I disagree, because the reason is that the what the court said in Hectathorn is that there's nothing in 41A which gives the ability to sanction attorneys, to put an award against attorneys. And what happens here, joint or several individual, it still becomes a sanction. Congress did not give an independent ground, an independent basis for the court to assess an award against the attorneys. It's only against the party. There's nothing in the statute, and there's nothing that gives that award. And that's why the subsequent decision of Hectathorn really, in my mind, is controlling in that regard.
But wasn't, am I misremembering UniOil? I thought there it was jointly and severally imposed on both the party and the party's attorneys.
Well, two things. One, it was an or. It wasn't jointly or severally, it said or. Uh-huh. But more importantly, that issue was not raised in UniOil, but it was raised in Hectathorn, which is a subsequent decision. I'm sorry, subsequent decision.
Well,
UniOil is in 87. Hectathorn is in 93.
So in our circuit, I guess the one that's earlier decided stands because we don't have authority as a panel to overrule a prior decision, right?
No, but I think the reason is that, first of all, there was an issue that was not brought up in Unit Oil that was brought up in Heckahorn. And in Heckahorn, the issue was whether or not 41A2 gives the power to impose an award against attorneys. And they said no because it's a sanction, and you can't do a sanction. And that is a fundamental problem.
Well, you want the client to pay the money?
Do I want the client? I don't want the client to pay anything.
I mean, but who should pay it, then, the client?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the client file this lawsuit?
Yes, the client did file the lawsuit.
Filed all three lawsuits?
No, did not file the lawsuits, but here is the essence. What Your Honor is saying is that there's some sort
of... I'm not saying anything. I'm just asking you questions.
Oh, of course, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The client did not file the lawsuit. The client did file the lawsuit. Physically, the attorneys did, but they did it as agents for the client. So the determination of whether or not the action should be withdrawn is really ultimately the client's decision without prejudice. And the problem is again, if we look at the statute...
Well, if it's without prejudice, then you can file it again.
Right, and the client
somewhere
could...
Somewhere else.
If the client wanted to, or the, you know, a client could decide not to file it at all. In this situation, the client never...
How many members of the class are there?
The putative class probably had millions.
Millions. Did you consult with all those members of the putative class?
I did not,
class?
Your Honor.
No, but... So it was your firm that filed the lawsuit, and you wanted to get out of it. You wanted to get out of that place where you were. And so the judge said, okay, you want to get out of it without prejudice. You put these people on the other side to a certain expense. You know, what did they ask for, $400,000 or something like that?
They asked for originally $150,000, and they dropped it to $130,000, and ultimately...
Who asked for it?
Brother, the defendant. Brother asked for that amount of money.
Yeah, but the judge gave only $100,000.
She gave $100,000, yeah.
She gave $100,000, correct.
Yeah.
Ultimately. And the real problem here, again, is that if we look at Koch, you can't put the plaintiffs in a position of saying it's going to be a range... Without analysis. There has to be analysis. We have to have the right to have the judge actually go through and make an analysis, which was not done here. And the only way that we can preserve our rights, and the only way that we can get review of this, is if we do exactly what we
did. Why did you want to dismiss it without prejudice?
Why did we want to?
Yeah.
One option was that plaintiff could ultimately become a party in another class action as a class rep, potentially. But what happened here, and that's really the point, there comes a point in time from a principal standpoint, which is the situation here, where there's a wrong decision made by the district court, and we want to bring this up on appeal. And the only way to bring it up on appeal, and the only way to preserve our rights, because if Judge Fisher said it's between $100,000 and $1 million.
But there were pages and pages of declarations and descriptions explaining how each line item was or was not useful in future litigation. Why is that not enough to bring the court's decision out of the clear error range?
The problem is that the court didn't make any determination. The court did not make an analysis. The court did not say anything in particular, especially at the 100th to the 110th juncture. At that point, it's more of a tentative guesstimate. The court says, I'm going to make a decision in the future, but you have to decide now whether or not you want to stay
in. Well, it was a very narrow range, you know. I mean, there are very few things in the law that are certain, I suppose, except death and taxes, as they say.
But the real point from our perspective is that if she were to make the analysis, which we hoped she would make, that she would come to realize that this was, in fact, the vast majority of the time, such as motions to dismiss, such as legal research, the items that were usable in other litigation, especially when you have motions to dismiss that actually took place in other litigation. And the point is that if there was an analysis made, if there was a full rendering of decision, that would be fine. But what we have here is something which is much more reminiscent of
Well, you had a chance to dismiss it.
Of the Cox situation.
You had a chance to dismiss it without prejudice before the response of pleading was filed.
Right, and we made a decision later to make that motion to dismiss, and all we asked from the court was to make the determination. Tell us exactly what the number is and make a determination. She did not make any determination. All she did was, in essence, make a punitive number. I mean, the $100,000 number itself.
So, but you consented to the $100,000 to $110,000 by not withdrawing the motion. That's how our cases work. And then there's an exception, I guess UniOil indicates, if the conditions impose actual legal prejudice, but says that's not cost and fees. So it'd have to be something that limits your ability to do a follow-up action. So I guess I'm still not understanding why UniOil doesn't just deprive us of jurisdiction over this.
Well, the first is that when we made our objection, we said we're objecting because Your Honor's not making that determination. So this was not a situation like in UniOil. So we not only said that we we're not withdrawing our request, but we said we're objecting that Your Honor is not telling us what the award number is.
But doesn't UniOil seem to indicate that if you don't withdraw your motion, you're sort of stuck unless there's a legal prejudice in the order that's ultimately issued by the district court?
And we say that there was legal prejudice, number one, that she did not make the calculation that she was supposed to make.
But how does that hurt your ability to carry on further cases? That seems to be how UniOil defines legal prejudice.
No, I think legal prejudice goes beyond that. I mean, in fact, here, the imposing, frankly, of the obligation of attorneys to pay, we believe is not consonant with 41A2, and that's imposing a condition that would take it out of the UniOil situation. The fact that, again, this was not calculated. I think there's a big problem here, especially when there's no analysis done. All that's happening here is the judge is saying, this is something that I will do, I'll give you a final number in the future. And on the 41A2, you just can't go that route. You have to be able to tell the parties what is the number.
It was clear the max was $110,000, was it not?
It was clear that it would be $110,000.
Wasn't that enough?
What?
Why wasn't that enough?
Because the problem is that we have a right. First of all, the point is we believe that the number should be much lower. We believe that if she did make a full analysis, her final award would probably be much lower if she abided by what the law and the rules are.
Well, she certainly reduced the amount they asked for, and she certainly had pages and pages of declarations and things to assist her in doing that. But it's hard for me to understand why you were mystified when a great deal more had been claimed. She reduced it, obviously considering the other cases that were pending. At any rate, I think I've stated my...
I understand.
You had two cases filed, didn't you?
There were two... We had one case filed.
You had one case filed.
And there was another case that was pending with another party.
Weren't there two down here?
There were two down here, and this was...
So you had two down here, and you had one...
No, I didn't have two down here.
There were two down here, and there was one back. We're in New Jersey.
We were co-counsel in New Jersey. We had one case here, and there were other attorneys who were prosecuting the same type of case here.
Yeah.
When we went out, virtually everything that the brother used in our case could be used in the pending case. There was no analysis done of that. And the problem is, fundamentally, our rights have been violated because Judge Fisher didn't make the analysis. And on its face, when you have over 70...
She had all those records and everything else over there. Saved you $10,000.
Your Honor, it was not saving us $10,000. It should have been dramatically lower, but she didn't make the analysis. You look at this record. All she says is, this is the number. And she says, I made a reason. She doesn't tell anything. And I think the court, even in UniOil and in Koch, requires more. You have to be able to tell when you're making an award, because Your Honors are deprived of any ability to know what was cut, what was not cut, why, which was done. There's nothing out there, and this record's barren of that. And when we're talking about an ability to make a determination, from my standpoint, my client's standpoint, and the court, there's nothing in this record that Judge Fisher did which lets us know what's happening. That's how we're prejudiced.
You made your point and your time is up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Karen Walter.
How do you answer his point?
Well,
there was insufficient analysis. Suppose that, for instance, the district court had included fees used in a Kendall litigation. That would be clear error, would it not? So would we need to at least remand the case for the district court for clarification? What would your response be?
The findings that the court made, she made a specific finding that her award was based on the submissions of the defendant. And as you've noted, those were quite extensive. Our initial request, we took the time entries from over a year's worth of billing records. We had declarations describing what that was, carving that up, putting that into 11 different categories, excluding some of the time that we recognized would be useful in continuing litigation between the parties. We came up with a number of about 151,000. We then, in our own demand papers, reduced that by 10%, saying that that would, you know, sort of be a cushion for recognizing that this allocation of time was, you know, sort of inherently uncertain. So our award for just fees, not costs, at that point came down to 136,000. When the court further asked us to consider, okay, well, what if we had to pull out work that was also useful in Kendall, the number came out again down to, at that point, I think we were down to, like, it was 109,000, I think, at that point. And then the court ultimately looked at that. She did make findings in one of her orders that she was going to reduce that time further as a result of inadequate documentation and arguably excessive time spent on some tasks. So that was how she came down to the 100,000. So if you look at all of the supporting documentation, you can track how the court would arrive at that number. It was not a number that was arrived at by, you know, throwing a dart or without doing any analysis. It was a number that was supported by the evidence and declarations that were submitted by the defendants.
Hey. You argued before the district court that Kendall should not be considered litigation between the parties, and so wasn't covered by the Koch test. Is it clear, in other words, is subtracting for Kendall or not subtracting for Kendall, would that be clear error? Do we have any cases that would indicate what constitutes litigation between the parties, or are you still taking the position that Kendall was not litigation between the parties for purposes of the Koch test?
Yes, we are still taking the position that Kendall was not litigation between these parties for purposes of the Koch test. However, you know, if the court did address that, then that would have reduced the number even further. And so in that, if the court considered it continuing litigation between the parties, then the plaintiffs in this matter would not have been prejudiced by her decision to do that, as that would have reduced the number even further. Just to quickly address the point that Your Honor brought up about a jurisdiction, we would agree that Unioil is controlling, that the points that my opponent made trying to distinguish this case from Unioil, that it also involved an assessment against the attorneys, is actually not a point of distinction, as Your Honor pointed out. That was also true in Unioil. And the fact that there was a range that was stated rather than a specific number is also not a sufficient point of distinction, given, as Your Honors commented earlier, that that was not something that was ultimately prejudicial, since they knew it was going to be at least $100,000, and with that knowledge decided they were not going to withdraw their motion, and then ultimately the amount that was awarded was the $100,000.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure.
In Koch, the court did go into very much detail saying what needs to be stated in a determination that's been made in a fee award, in an award determination. And in that case, it's very similar to this situation where essentially the court deferred and then didn't say what the basis of its determination was. And the Ninth Circuit said that's not good enough. It has to be sent back because that determination
was. Was that a class action?
Is that a class action?
You tell us about it.
It's either a class action or a master action that involved investors, and that was the situation. It says investors. I do not know whether or not that particular case was a class action, Your Honor. But the one thing that's very clear is that when we're put in a position that the court says prospectively, I will make a determination, under 41A2, she can't deprive us of our right and opportunity to know what the actual amount is before we make a decision. And if we just could, if that's a substantial, that's,
well,
that's
but
a purchase.
Well, but you know what it was going to be. She told you it was 100 to 110,000, right? Somewhere in there.
Well, she actually said that.
She said that.
She said that, but frankly, if she were to make a full review, it could be less, it could be more.
Yeah, but she told you that. So, you know, if you're awake, you'd know where it was going to fall. Okay? So why at that time you say, well, we withdraw our motion to dismiss?
Because this was, again, everything along the lines here was, this was, frankly, just a bullying situation where there was no determination made. We wanted the determination made. We wanted to preserve our rights.
Why did you want? She told you it was going to be between 100 and 110,000, and she had all these records out there.
But she
and you'd have to be asleep not to know it was going to go somewhere between 100 and 110. And you didn't ask to withdraw your motion to dismiss. It's going to go that way. So you had a chance then to pull back, but you didn't do it.
Because we wanted to be sure, we wanted to preserve the rights that she does this the right way, and she didn't do it the right way.
Well, but did you do it the right way?
I believe so, Your Honor. We did it the right way because we wanted to.
Because you wanted to get out of that courtroom. That's what you wanted. You wanted to get out of that courtroom. Isn't that right?
We could have dismissed with prejudice as well.
Yeah, well, but if you'd have done that, that might have had an effect on some other case you'd filed.
I don't think it could possibly.
Well, you know, people could argue about that.
I think it's.
So then why don't you go in there and dismiss it with prejudice?
Because, again, the idea is there comes a point in time when somebody is violating the rules and violating the principles, we have a right to say no and fight this, and this is what we're doing.
Okay, fine. We've heard you, and you've over your time.
Okay, thank you very much,
Your
Honor. And
I hope you got enough money for tuition to Occidental. Okay. You can write the check out now.
I wish I'd known you about it. You were in trouble with other things going on. But it's up to you.
Next time you come, let us know in advance. Did we know in advance?
I've been actually notified before.
What?
Last time we were here, we had the opportunity to actually meet with some of the sitting judges and their clerks.
It's come up here.
So I had actually notified the court by mail, as I have done last year or last semester and the semester before, because I requested the opportunity, if
judges were available and their clerks were available to meet with us afterwards, which has been granted before. But unfortunately, I didn't get any response back from the court this time. So.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, most of us are very happy to meet with students.
Right.
Need to know in advance. We have to
exactly.
go to the conference. It's going to be...
I know. We've sat before with conference, and then sometimes we've chatted before conference, and I absolutely understand that, and I had hoped that we'd have the opportunity, but I recognize that things are also very busy, and so I just didn't want to be
well, sometimes
too
we have
obnoxious.
Other guests coming. I have the Egyptian ambassador.
Yeah.
I have
okay.
people coming from Ohio this afternoon. And,
wow.
Sometimes we'd be very happy to meet with you. I'm a former law professor. I really enjoy meeting with students.
Right.
And I know that Judge Ferguson is old, but the time.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Judge
and
Nelson
is
a former dean of USC mm-hmm. Law School, you know. And
my son went to Occidental.
Yay!
But then he became a Trojan, so.
Yeah. So there's a little
but
bit of
I, you know, we'd really, I'd love to talk to him. And I've got, you know, I haven't been able to convince any of my granddaughters.